tomorrow, gentlemen. We'll be in Las Vegas.
Welcome to Vegas.
Las Vegas functions on a 24-hour-a-day schedule.
The pools, the casino.
Big volcano out in front.
That's the Eiffel Tower.
Bellagio.
Riviera.
The Mirage.
Flamingo.
Sahara.
The MGM Grand.
This isn't the real Caesar's Palace, is it?
On a camel.
They always put the machines that pay off the most right in the front.
Good luck.
Strip is just the most amazing stretch of road, I think, probably anywhere in the world.
Kicking ass in Vegas.
Vegas, baby.
Vegas, baby.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
Once again, every time we get to record a vintage segment, it's kind of a...
It really is a treat.
It's an event, really. I mean, we have to set aside special time together. We take it very seriously. It's not like a regular show where we're just trying to make each other laugh. We have serious information that we want to share with people, and we want to do it in a very serious way.
Yeah, the people and events that we cover in the Vintage Vegas segment, I think we need to address with a different level of respect. Certainly sums up the reason for our approach.
Well, and once again, this is, you know, you helped to inspire this as the birth of the entire 360 Vegas podcast concept. So it means a whole lot to me, and so does this week's character.
Character, I think, would be an understatement.
Right.
A huge, huge icon in the not only in Vegas history, but in the history of pop culture.
Absolutely. So this week, we're going to talk to you about Elvis Presley in Vegas. Elvis Presley virtually invented celebrity as we know it. Unfortunately, he also became its first victim. Imagine being a shy mama's boy who never matured past his late teens to early 20s, because at the time when most people are learning who they are from their mistakes, everyone around Elvis told him he was a genius. He was encouraged to not let people change him. Go with your instincts. Elvis Presley not only became Las Vegas' biggest draw, but changed the face of music and pop culture forever. Unfortunately, his memory has become bastardized by the myriad of performers who impersonate his talent during the darkest time of his life. While most don't do this with malicious intent, Fat Elvis has become a common caricature in Vegas, representing one of the most amazing, iconic performers of all time.
Elvis Presley exploded into the national consciousness in 1956 and rapidly became the most popular musician in history. However, in the midst of all that success, the first time he performed in Las Vegas at the New Frontier, it was very poorly received. Many blame this primarily on the middle-aged conservative hotel guests in the audience, hardly Presley's core families. The 56 Vegas booking was kind of a rushed-together affair, so much that it wasn't widely reported in trade papers like it would normally be with a rising star of Elvis's caliber.
Elvis was booked as the closer for the first 2 weeks of the four-week Freddie Martin Orchestra engagement. The performances would be held in the New Frontier's 1,000-seat Venus Room. To advertise the upcoming performances, the property set up a 24-foot-tall Elvis Presley cutout, the same picture used on Elvis' first album, in front of the hotel beside the casino entrance. Just below comedian Chucky Green, the marquee advertised extra added attraction, Elvis Presley. Print ads advertised him as the atomic-powered singer. Elvis came out noticeably nervous in the first performance of the residency. He stammered to thank Freddie Martin for the introduction and joked that their opening song was Heartburn Motel, which received virtually no reaction from the crowd. The band would later say the performance was the first time they had been able to hear themselves play and realize how out of tune they were.
The New Frontier's Vice President T.W. Richardson was in the audience and was very excited to have Elvis performing at his resort. He had been a big fan since hearing Elvis perform in his hometown of Biloxi. Wanting to share Elvis with some of his friends, he invited many to attend the first show. When Elvis and the boys finally started playing, some of his guests remarked, "What is all this yelling and screaming? I can't take this. Let's go to the tables and gamble." After their first performance, they stopped being the closers. Despite a crowd that clearly didn't find Elvis to their liking, he never stopped trying to win them over. and the entire residency wasn't a flop.
Realizing that the stereotypical Vegas audience was not Elvis' demographic, the New Frontier scheduled a teenage matinee with proceeds going towards lights for a youth baseball park. The response was absolute bedlam. The theater was jam-packed and surrounded by those who couldn't make it in for the performance but still wanted to hear their idol perform. As was common at the time, at some point during the performance, the crowd swarmed the stage and tore the shirt off of Elvis, then ravaged it to pieces. The capture of as little as a button from the shirt elicited squeals of joy. Overall, Elvis would go on to describe the less than successful residency in Vegas as 28 12-minute shows, two per night, over 14 days. The rest of the time was spent doing whatever they wanted to, which would equate to hours of riding the Dodgem cars at the local amusement park, hanging out by the pool, chasing girls, watching movies and Vegas shows, and staying up all night.
But for all the time he spent in Vegas during this residency, he didn't drink and didn't gamble. Elvis just said neither appealed to him. Elvis's mom was a big fan of Liberace, so he made it a point to get an autograph for her when they met for the first time in Vegas. This meeting produced a famous picture of the two stars switching the instruments they are most well known for and feigning a jam session. Elvis was a big fan of the lounge act, the Bellboys at the Sands. He especially liked their closing number, Hound Dog, a minor hit for them the previous year. Elvis was already familiar with the Big Mama Thornton song, but didn't become interested in adding it to their set list until seeing the Bellboys perform it. Elvis decided he wanted to incorporate it into his show, but out of respect for the Bellboys, not while they were performing in Vegas. Guitarist Scotty Moore would later admit that they stole it right from him.
In the end, the boys and even the colonel would consider the residency to be a valuable learning experience for them. It was largely considered to be the one misstep in Elvis' career, a reminder that they still needed to work hard to keep climbing to the top. In perspective, by the end of the Vegas residency, Heartbreak Hotel was number one on the charts. I Want You, I Need You, I Love You was released to advance sales of 300,000, and RCA Victor reported that Elvis Records accounted for half of their pop sales. The final Vegas performance in 1956 was recorded and bootlegged by a member of the audience. 25 years later, RCA would release it.
Las Vegas would become Elvis's favorite place to vacation because it never went to sleep, just like him. Just before the release of his first movie, Love Me Tender, Elvis was feeling nervous. So he took the colonel's advice and went on vacation to Vegas. While Elvis was still a celebrity in Las Vegas, he was a celebrity among celebrities. Of course, his comings and goings were reported on, but from a distance, which suited Elvis just fine. While Elvis's use of prescription drugs, specifically uppers and downers, can be traced back to his time in the military, and then in an attempt to keep up with his constantly busy schedule, Vegas was a place where they were used to squeeze a little extra fun out of life. However, over time, the excessive use of uppers required downers to get some sleep, which then required uppers to get past the grogginess of the downers.
Elvis and crew went to Vegas a lot after the war, before, during, and after many of the filming of his movies, usually staying at the Sahara because the colonel was friends with the owner, Milton Prell. Rather than go home to Graceland after he finished filming Kid Galahad in 61, he decided to stay in Vegas for Christmas and New Year's. The next time Elvis would perform in Vegas would be in the movie Viva Las Vegas. Viva Las Vegas was the story of race car driver Lucky Jackson, who comes to Vegas to compete in the Las Vegas Grand Prix. While trying to get money to replace the engine in his car, he meets Rusty Martin, a.k.a. Ann Margaret, a swimming pool instructor in Vegas, and becomes smitten with her. After losing all his money, Lucky is forced to work as a waiter at the hotel to pay off his bill. In a last-ditch effort, he tries to win the hotel's talent show so he can take the prize money and buy himself a new engine and still enter the race.
When Elvis learned that his next movie was to be set in Vegas, he got excited. More excited to do a movie in a long time. The first few days of production were spent in the recording studio. Elvis recorded 12 songs for the film, but only 6 were released on records, as the idea of a full-length soundtrack were not considered at the time. In January of 2012, Sony released an official full-length soundtrack on CD for the movie as part of Elvis's 75th birthday anniversary. Elvis and his love interest in the movie, Ann Margaret, recorded 2 duets for the film. The Lady Loves Me made it into the movie. The Year the Boss did not, but was later released. Elvis's co-star Anne Margaret was discovered by George Burns only a few years before and was just coming off her biggest movie, an Elvis-inspired musical called Bye Bye Birdie.
Filming began July 15, 1963, with an opening date scheduled for June 17, 1964. The filming of the song Viva Las Vegas, which he performs at the talent show, was performed in one single unedited shot, the only known example of that technique being used in Elvis' movie career. An interesting side note, one of the guitar players in the movie is Glenn Campbell, who was a session musician for artists like Bobby Darin, The Monkees, and more, including Elvis. Campbell would go on to have a successful solo career, probably best known for his hit, Rhinestone Cowboy.
The movie boasts one of the best kart race sequences ever filmed at the time. The wedding scene was filmed at the Little Church of the West, which is still open for business today, south of Mandalay Bay, across the street. It was originally located at the Last Frontier, but was moved to make way for the Fashion Show Mall. It relocated to the Hacienda until that was destroyed so Mandalay Bay could be built in 1996. It has been at its current location ever since and deemed a national historic place, not just for being in Viva Las Vegas, but actually playing host to many famous weddings, including Richard Gere and Sidney Crawford in 1981, Noel Gallagher in 1997, and Billy Bob Thornton and Angelina Jolie in the year 2000. The wedding scene in the film sparked tabloid journalists to report that Elvis and Anne Margaret actually got married, but this was never the case. However, it did make his girlfriend at the time, Priscilla Boulay, very jealous.
Some believe Viva Las Vegas to be some of Elvis' best acting work, as well as his best movie. The opening sequence has possibly the best collection of aerial footage of old Vegas ever filmed. In this movie, the songs actually help to tell the story and develop the character, and not just take advantage of Elvis' talents and selling power. Unlike most Elvis movies, he shared the spotlight with his co-star. For the first time, he was performing with a talent of similar skills. In fact, many referred to Anne Margaret as the female Elvis. Some even argue that Anne Margaret steals the movie with her dancing, so much that the director was accused of showing too much of Anne Margaret's body and shaking lady parts that it bordered on tasteless.
During the filming of the movie, it's reported that Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, and the director fought repeatedly over many things. The reoccurring argument was the amount of screen time Anne Margaret received during the dance numbers. The issue revolved around a member of the film crew who used to date Anne Margaret and was still hung up on her. It became obvious that he was lighting and filming Anne Margaret better than Elvis. Elvis, of course, knew this wasn't Anne's fault.
Viva Las Vegas filmed in various locations around Vegas, including the parking lot of Sahara, Lake Mead, and the Last Frontier in the Old West town scene. They filmed at the Skeet Shoot Range at Tropicana, McCarran Airport, and the swimming pool at Flamingo. As was common when he made a movie, Elvis and Anne Margaret became an item during the filming. Elvis became so enamored with Anne that at one point he asked Colonel to manage her. He would not.
MGM released the movie May 20th, 1964. In the UK, the movie had to be renamed to Love in Las Vegas because Britain already had a movie playing in theaters named Viva Las Vegas. The movie cost the studio $1 to $3 million, depending on the source reporting it, and went on to gross $9.4 million worldwide, Elvis's highest-grossing film ever. It was the 11th highest-grossing movie of the year, and after the movie came out, visitation to the city increased tremendously.
Elvis' next encounter in Vegas was in 1967, when he married longtime girlfriend Priscilla Boulay at the Aladdin Casino Hotel in Vegas. Despite reservations, the encouragement of a few of the boys who recently got married, Elvis finally agreed on a date to marry Priscilla. To no one's surprise, the Colonel went to Vegas to take care of the details. Invitations were sent out in secret to family and friends. At 3 a.m. on May 1st, 1967, Elvis and Priscilla paid $15 for a marriage license at the Clark County Courthouse, then went to the Aladdin for the ceremony. The Aladdin was the property of choice because it was recently purchased by Colonel's longtime friend and previous Sahara owner, Milton Prell. The couple were married in an 8-minute ceremony conducted by Nevada Supreme Court Judge David Zenoff at 11:41 a.m. Per the Colonel's instructions, other than co-best men, the rest of the Memphis Mafia were not permitted to attend the ceremony.
Boys were, of course, upset, but directed their fury towards the Colonel. Elvis never had the stomach to tell the Colonel no. During the ceremony, Elvis and Priscilla were understandably nervous and didn't realize at the time who was missing. Only after did they agree that at least Red should have been there. However, this was something Red would never forgive Elvis for. Red could understand Elvis not standing up to the Colonel for matters of business, but this was personal. The Colonel rationalized that since the ceremony was being held in a confined space, Milton Prell's private living quarters at the property, there just wasn't enough room for everyone. So to avoid the appearance of favoritism, none could come to the ceremony, but they could all go to the reception afterward.
After the ceremony, the couple made their way through the pool into the Aladdin room, where a press conference was called to announce the news. When asked why he finally tied the knot, Elvis just replied, "Well, I guess it was about time." It was reported that 100 people attended the reception, which featured a buffet estimated to cost $10,000, with everything from Southern Fried Chicken, Suckling Pig, to Oysters Rockefeller and Champagne. Some credit Elvis with making it cool to get married in Vegas, but in truth, celebrities had been doing it for many years. 9 months to the day they were married, Priscilla gives birth to Elvis' only child, Lisa Marie, February 1st, 1968.
As happy as Elvis was in his personal life, he was equally unhappy with the state of his career. His recording career was at an all-time low, and his movie career was in decline. From January of 1967 through May of 1968, only two of Elvis's singles charted in the top 40, and neither was higher than 28. The Speedway soundtrack that year topped out at 82 on the Billboard chart. Now that Elvis fulfilled all of his movie obligations, Elvis and the Colonel plotted a return to music performing. A deal with NBC was reached to finance what would be called Elvis, and later known as the 68 Comeback Special. The show would be Elvis's first TV appearance since 1961. The show was a massive success, NBC's highest rated show of the season, capturing 42% of the viewing audience. The person everyone knew and loved was back playing guitar, singing, and dancing uninhibited. The album came out in 1969 and reached the top 10 on the charts. After the success of the TV performance, Elvis was eager to perform live again.
Right away, the Colonel set his sights on Las Vegas. Specifically, the under-construction International Hotel that had plans to be the largest, best casino hotel in the world. 30 stories tall, 1,512 rooms, and a showroom with a capacity of 2,000. The Colonel also liked the man behind the project, Kirk Kerkorian, who reminded the Colonel of himself, a self-made man with an eighth-grade education and modest taste despite being one of the richest men on the planet. The Colonel wanted $500,000 for 4 weeks, one show per night, 2 one-weekends with Monday off. They would accept a two-week engagement if it were preferred, but the price would be $300,000. They also wanted the option of recording a soundtrack as well as a TV special with all facilities being provided by the property. It only took 9 days for the deal to be accepted with a few changes. The residency would be for 4 weeks, and just like all Vegas headliners, Elvis would be required to play two shows per night. The $500,000 salary would be approved if Elvis was the artist at the grand opening of the property. Otherwise, it would be reduced to $400,000 for the run matching what major headliners and proven moneymakers like Sinatra and Dean Martin got. However, a provision was listed in the contract to pay Elvis a $50,000 penalty should any headliners make more than $400,000 within a year of the engagement. Everything else was approved, including an option for a second four-week residency that would include all the same numbers and provisions listed for Elvis, should the International decide to exercise it.
The Colonel accepted the $400,000 deal, justifying it by not wanting to put Elvis in an untested showroom that may have bugs that needed to be worked out. In May of 1969, Elvis signed with the new International Hotel, better known as the Las Vegas Hilton and currently known as the LVH. He was scheduled to perform 57 shows over 4 weeks, beginning July 31st. This would be Elvis's first live performance in Vegas since he bombed in 56, so he was obviously very nervous. Despite the years of work he had done with his original band, various session musicians in Memphis and California, Elvis went with a group of musicians he had never directly worked with. The new band was made up of the best accompaniment performers available, anchored by guitarist James Burton, who Elvis had admired for a long time. James's resume included working with the likes of Sinatra, Merle Haggard, and Ricky Nelson. So much of the show was being guided by feelings. For example, it was said that the drummer they selected, Ronnie Tutt, wasn't necessarily the best drummer who auditioned, but didn't just play what he wanted. He watched Elvis for cues, adapted his rhythm to what Elvis was doing. This would prove to be extremely valuable, as Elvis likes to ad-lib, throw in some karate moves and some other dramatic flares.
Elvis brought in two sets of backup singers, Imperials, who he had worked with on his 1966 gospel album, and the Sweet Inspirations, a band he never met or seen perform, but loved their self-titled song Sweet Inspirations, as well as the work they did backing up Aretha Franklin. A side note, one of the members of the Sweet Inspirations was Sissy Houston, Whitney Houston's mom. Elvis commissioned the man who made the famous black leather suit Elvis wore in his 68 comeback special to build him a jumpsuit he would become known for in his later performing days. When auditions were over and rehearsal started, the band would report that these were more of personal performances in and of themselves than rehearsals. They also learned and practiced close to 150 different songs, so they had plenty to choose from each show. Elvis was also a tremendous collaborator during these sessions. Rhythm guitarist John Wilkinson admitted to having difficulty playing It's Now or Never the way Elvis wanted it played. At one point, John went off on his own to work on it when Elvis came over and began softly singing the harmony part while John sang lead and finally got the song where Elvis wanted it.
The band was a collection of every musical style Elvis loved, from the rock and roll sound of his lead guys, the gospel and blues sound of his two quartets, as well as the big band sound provided by the Showroom Orchestra. When rehearsals moved to Vegas, Barbra Streisand was still using the showroom for her grand opening engagement, so Elvis and crew rehearsed in either one of the rehearsal rooms or an open ballroom at the International. The Vegas rehearsals were the first time they practiced with the two backup groups. Reservations were common among pretty much everyone at first. It wasn't cool to like Elvis in 1968, but everyone came around after playing with him and seeing how much he loved to perform and how much passion he sang with. Even the Sweet Inspirations were quickly won over after admitting they didn't know much about Elvis and didn't particularly like his style of music.
The first day of rehearsals with the Sweet Inspirations, Elvis came right up to them, casually sitting down and introducing himself. Shortly after, he began to sing his favorite song of theirs with them. They fell in love with his passion. Rehearsals were complete run-throughs of the show. Elvis was a great diplomat, stopping during rehearsals and sharing his thoughts about what he wanted and didn't. He encouraged experimentation, but knew right away what he liked and what he didn't like. Everything seemed to be falling into place. Chemistry was developing. When not in rehearsals, Elvis went to several shows in Vegas to watch how they performed and what the audiences reacted to. He wanted to learn what to do and what not to do.
True to form, the Colonel had an all-out media blitz and every type of souvenir you can think made up. The Colonel plastered billboards all over the city, and the response was the largest advance sales in Vegas history. Roughly 80% of the tickets were sold for the entire engagement before the first show, but the Colonel was relentless. After Barbara's show closed, and while her stage crew began tearing down her set, the Colonel's crew started setting up shop, and by the following morning, already had an Elvis merchandise booth set up in the lobby. All of the Streisand promotional material in the International was replaced with Elvis. The Colonel timed the release of Elvis' latest album, From Elvis in Memphis, to come out in June of 69. He also had the 68 comeback special re-aired on August 17th, in the middle of a month-long residency.
Opening night was July 31st. It was one show, invitation only, and attended by the A-list of celebrities, musicians, and the who's who in the industry. Colonel Tom Parker and Kurt Kerkorian intended to make this the show business event of the year, going as far as having Kerkorian send his private plane to New York to bring rock journalists to the show. The pressure hit Elvis at the afternoon rehearsals the day of the show. Elvis hadn't performed live in a long time and didn't know what the reaction would be. Performing in front of a crowd for the NBC special while being filmed was one thing, but there was no editing in a live performance. All the pressure would be on him to deliver. The Sweet Inspirations opened, and comic Sammy Shore entertained after that. Elvis took the stage without an introduction and received a standing ovation before singing a single note. It would be the first of three he would receive on the night. Elvis was so moved by the response that he was brought to tears. When Elvis began to perform, he started off at a rapid-fire pace, beginning with Blue Suede Shoes, and the crowd exploded. He followed with I Got a Woman into All Shook Up, slowing with Love Me Tender, then cranked it back up with Jailhouse Rock and Don't Be Cruel until he finally stopped and addressed the audience.
Elvis was charming and self-deprecating. He joked about the International Theater decor and joked that, before the evening's out, I'm sure I will have made a complete and utter fool of myself, but I hope you get a kick out of watching. As the show continued, Elvis became less nervous and started having fun and became playful, displaying his fondness for puns and wordplay. Elvis had so much energy, he was all over the stage doing flips and somersaults and almost hurt himself, but you could tell he was having the time of his life. For fear that he would hurt himself at some point, Elvis was talked out of not doing them in future performances. When the first performance was done and Elvis made his way backstage, there was almost a palpable sense of relief. The Colonel, a man who prided himself on not showing emotion, had tears in his eyes, then hugged Elvis. He was proud of his boy. It was after this performance at a press conference that a journalist referred to Elvis as the King of Rock and Roll. Elvis tried to deflect this compliment to Fats Domino, who was in attendance, but the name stuck.
After the conference, Elvis and crew retreated up to his suite on the 29th floor with friends and family because the ultra-luxurious star suite being built for him on the 30th floor was still under construction. That suite, room 3000, is now known as the Elvis Suite, 5,000 square feet. It didn't take the International long to notice the overwhelming success of the residency. In fact, it took about 90 to 120 minutes. The International exercised their option for another four-week residency after the opening night performance. In classic Colonel fashion, the contract was reworked, getting Elvis a raise for his services, as well as a long-term deal to perform 8 weeks a year, 2 4-week residencies each year for the next 5 years at $1 million per year. A clause was also put into the contract that no one in Vegas could ever make as much as Elvis during his residencies, whether it be money or amenities. The International couldn't sign the papers fast enough.
The more shows Elvis did, the more relaxed he became. Every audience was treated to a different story about how he got into music, as well as brief recaps of events in his career. He explained that despite his success in the movies, performing for the camera just wasn't the same. He missed performing in front of a live audience. During performances, Elvis made sure to engage his female fans. It started with giving out random kisses and sweaty scarves. When he didn't have a scarf and needed to mop up some sweat, women offered their own scarves, handkerchiefs, or cloth napkins. After the first few shows, his female fans became less subtle, throwing bras, panties, and half slips on the stage.
Elvis' onstage antics and impromptu karate demonstrations would frequently split his pants. One night, he had to sing Memories from behind the curtain while he changed his pants. This is the main reason why Elvis moved from regular trousers to the jumpsuits he would become famous for late in his career. A jumpsuit would provide more freedom of movement as well as a unique look. He became so relaxed on stage, it began to concern the Colonel. Elvis began using more adult language than the Colonel would have liked and shared his point of view about things that might not have been very popular to hear. The Colonel knew he had to convince Elvis that it was in his best interest to not alienate his audience with unpopular sentiments, but Elvis did what he wanted for the most part.
Despite all the spectacle, the music and performance was tight and on point. The show overflowed with energy and engaged the entire audience every single night. Friends and celebrities all over came to see the show. Old friends from Memphis reported back that the show was unlike anything you'd ever seen before. Indescribable. You had to see it to believe it. People who came into his life post his original live performing days, before all the moves, Priscilla included, described his presence and energy unlike anything they had ever seen before. He prowled the stage like a tiger. It was hard to believe that the man on the stage was the Elvis they all knew. Some nights, Elvis just didn't want to stop singing. Those nights, there was an after-party performance. Some nights, it would be Elvis and friends holding court. Other times, Imperials or Tom Jones just singing and playing until the sun came up. By the end of the run, he never wanted to come off the stage. He was back, reintroduced to his original love, and this time, he never wanted to leave her again.
The Vegas shows were an unmitigated success, commercially and financially, but most importantly, it gave Elvis the validation he had always wanted. And he got it by doing exactly what he wanted, going on instinct. 2 weeks after Elvis finished his run of 29 shows at the International, Variety reported Elvis broke Vegas attendance and gross sales records. 101,509 people went to see Elvis at the International, and with a cheapest ticket being $15, the International made $1.5 million. By comparison, Dean Martin attracted 50,000 in 3 weeks at the smaller Riviera earlier in the summer. After the residency ended, for the first time in almost 10 years, Elvis didn't have anything planned to do. No movies, recording sessions, or TV shows. Nothing was planned until rehearsals started back up for his return to the International in February 1970. Elvis earned and enjoyed a long vacation and was quite satisfied with his return. However, the high of performing on stage proved to only make Elvis' time off restless.
In 1970, MGM went into pre-production on a film of Elvis performing live at the International that would be called Elvis, That's the Way It Is, which had a working title of Standing Room Only. The movie would also have an accompanying album, which included both live and studio recordings. The filming of That's the Way It Is was done over 4 days and six shows. These performances would also be the first that Elvis began performing in the signature jumpsuits. The show was fun, he made jokes, very self-deprecating. In previews, the Colonel made it clear that he didn't like the movie. Not because Elvis looked a little puffy compared to his 68 special, but he didn't think the film focused on Elvis enough. He didn't like all the fan interviews and thought a scene showing the amount of stakes prepared for the show alienated Elvis's less affluent fans. However, the Colonel's superficial complaints don't compare to the real issue that occurred during performances in 1970. Death threats were received and considered serious enough for the FBI to convince Elvis to increase his security for the rest of the film.
Security at the hotel received a phone call telling them Elvis would be kidnapped that evening. Others in Elvis' camp received similar warnings of an assassination attempt at the next show. The next day, Colonel Parker received a similar phone call. The anonymous caller demanded $50,000 to reveal who the killer would be. A few hours later, a menu was found in Elvis' personal mailbox at the hotel, with Elvis' face destroyed on it and a drawing of a gun pointing at Elvis' chest with the message, "Guess who and where?" The FBI dusted it for fingerprints, but came up with nothing. Elvis still performed that night, not only with increased personal security, but with FBI in the crowd. During his next two shows, Elvis went on stage with a Derringer handgun in his right boot and a .45 pistol in his waistband, but performances had no problems. For the rest of the residency, members of the Memphis Mafia were stationed in the orchestra pit with guns ready. At another show, a maitre d' reported that a woman in the audience had a gun and was going to shoot Elvis. For the rest of that show, two members of the Memphis Mafia stood in front of the stage as a block, and Elvis performed sideways to make himself a smaller target. At the end of the show, nothing got to Elvis without going through the boys first. Elvis showed how grateful he was by boasting that his guys would take a bullet for him. That's the kind of loyalty he could get.
Elvis stirred crowds into a frenzy. People forgot how old they were. One of the members of the Memphis Mafia tells a story about one of the scarves Elvis threw into the crowd wrapped around a woman's neck. Two other women got a hold of each side of the scarf and fought over it while it strangled the woman whose neck it was wrapped around. It was clear this woman was choking to death, as these two women weren't letting go, so he pulled a knife and cut the scar in half to save her. The other two women fought over the shreds of the scarf, unaware or didn't care that they almost killed a person. But Elvis encouraged this kind of fanaticism, almost craving it.
Elvis could do no wrong. At times, he would forget the words to songs. Sometimes he would stop the band and start over while making fun of himself for the mistake. Other times he would just adjust and continue on. Sometimes he would spot other singers in the audience and do impromptu versions of their famous songs. As the show continued on, all involved became more familiar with each other and spent lots of time off stage. The final night of the residency, the midnight show ran until 3 a.m. Elvis acknowledged that sometimes he wished he could just come out on stage, relax, and sing like Dean Martin, but he knows the critics would say he can't move no more, and he didn't want to give them the satisfaction.
When the film was released November 11, 1970, it was the first non-dramatic film since the beginning of Elvis's movie career in 1956. The original movie was set as something of a documentary, showcasing Elvis's triumphant return to live performing. In 2001, That's the Way It Is was re-edited, removing all of the documentary footage in favor to more footage of Elvis practicing, preparing, and actually performing. 1970 also marked a return to performing full-time. When Elvis wasn't performing in Vegas, he was touring the country. During this time, he set six attendance records at the Houston Astrodome, and those performances were released on the album On Stage.
Those closest to Elvis also noticed there were two lives being lived. One over-the-top, larger-than-life version on stage, then the real life, which could never come close to the higher performing. By 71, like everything else in his life, the Vegas show and touring became routine and Elvis became restless. He busied himself with a procession of women more than willing to entertain him. It became clear to all that Elvis and Priscilla's marriage was an open one, at least from Elvis' side. At one point, a woman filed a lawsuit claiming she was the mother of Elvis' child. Elvis acknowledged it on stage, making a joke about it, but in truth, he was devastated. It also brought to light that his marriage was falling apart, something Elvis didn't seem to care much about at this point. He even commented once to a gossip columnist who saw Elvis playing blackjack at the International with a pair of beautiful women at his side. When the columnist remarked how great Elvis looked, Elvis said, "That's what a bad marriage does for you."
Both began seeing other people and the couple separated in February of 1972. After Priscilla confesses that she had begun seeing a karate instructor Elvis recommended she go to. They filed for divorce in August of the same year. Many believe that the failure of his marriage is the beginning of the end for Elvis. His remaining years would be full of epic drug-induced lows, encouraging recoveries as he tried to get off drugs only to relapse, usually worse than before. Despite the troubles in his personal life, Elvis's professional career continued to be a massive success. The stress, exhilaration, followed by boredom caused Elvis to return to his prescription pill usage. He had trouble sleeping after two adrenaline-filled performances a night.
Ironically, Elvis was vocally against recreational drug use and rarely drinks due to his experience with multiple family members' alcoholism. But Elvis didn't think his use of prescription medication should be referred to in the same way one would refer to the use of marijuana or other illegal substances. He rationalized that what he used were regulated by the FDA and prescribed by a doctor. It's also believed that if Elvis couldn't get the drugs he requested just by asking, with his extensive knowledge and physician's desk reference, he would simply fake the symptoms to get what he wanted. Sleeping pills then required amphetamines to counter the grogginess when he awoke. The guys thought it was fun to take sleeping pills and watch each other fight to see who fell asleep first. It wasn't long before his new/old recreational habit began to show. Elvis began to look puffy despite a very athletic performance.
When the Hilton purchased the International, the Colonel looked at it as an opportunity to renegotiate their contract. Elvis had an out clause in his contract in the event that the International was purchased. The first thing Hilton ownership did was to contact Elvis to make sure they could keep their headliner. The Colonel said they were unhappy with the way things had been going and wouldn't decide if they would be back in 1972 until after August 71 shows were done. Once he finally confirmed that they would be back, he negotiated a $25,000 bonus for each Elvis and himself, as well as the use of Baron Hilton's private plane for Elvis's upcoming tour at a favorable rate. The Colonel also made a point of saying the contract can be renegotiated upward, showing the Hilton that Elvis was Vegas's all-time box office earner by pulling in 3,840 people in his last run of shows, compared to 3,2600 for Barbra Streisand and 1,800 for Glenn Campbell.
The following August Vegas shows, and in the wake of his married life coming to an end, critics reported that a large amount of the songs Elvis performed at this time focused on love lost. It had very little karate and slim to no horseplay or jokes. For an artist who was known for rehearsing hundreds of songs just in the chance that he might one night want to perform them, his shows didn't change much from night to night. In 1971, Elvis added a cape to his signature jumpsuits. Some point to Elvis' belief that he was chosen for a purpose to do God's work as the reason for the move towards the messianic addition of the cape. He began to believe God's work for him was to allow people to forget about their troubles for a while, if only while enjoying his music and performances. One could argue that for being such a spiritual man, Elvis indulged in many ungodly activities. But Elvis believed that all the things that he did to the contrary, i.e. philandering, would all go away once his purpose was made clear to him, even after he claimed he determined what his purpose from God was. As performing became commonplace, Elvis became bored, and drug use increased.
It's during this time that Elvis would begin being treated by doctors for what today would be called depression. Both his emotional state and his return to excessive prescription drug use caused his live performances to suffer. He would frequently forget the words to his songs. In the beginning, he would have a guy under the plexiglass stage of the hotel with dummy cards with the words of a song. In time, he wouldn't even try to hide it, sometimes singing a song while reading from a piece of paper. Even through all this, Elvis's career continued to be successful.
During a show in January of 73, four crazed fans rushed to the stage, apparently planning to attack Elvis. Security leapt into action, but Elvis stayed to defend himself as well with his karate training and threw one of the assailants off the stage. Even once the situation was in hand, Elvis found it difficult to settle down, screaming at his assailants, "Come on, you motherfuckers!" Eventually, he calmed down enough to apologize to the audience, but even then, he interjected that he was sorry he didn't break his goddamn neck.
After the show, Elvis became obsessed with the notion that Mike Stone, the man who Priscilla left him for, sent men to kill him, even though no evidence could be found to substantiate that they were anything but overly enthusiastic fans. With only one thing on his mind, Elvis went into the closet of the Hilton Suite, grabbed an M16, gave it to one of his bodyguards, and reiterated that Mike Stone must die, arguing that he doesn't deserve to live after what he's done to Elvis. Elvis tended to fixate on things that may have been diagnosed as ADD today, considering his intense focus on things he loved, only to drop them all together until the mood strikes him again, if it ever did again. Normally when Elvis would get all keyed up about something, all he needed was to sleep it off, but this wasn't the case this time. Elvis was so convinced and furious at this perceived truth that for 2 days he insisted that he had to have Stone killed. Even after Elvis's on-call doctor gave him a sedative injection, the next morning it was still in the forefront of his mind. The fury with which he commanded his guys to kill Mike Stone was replaced by an even eerier calm, still requesting an update on the mission to finding someone to kill Mike Stone. The situation culminated when one of Elvis's longtime bodyguards actually found someone willing to do the job. $10,000 was the price, and when it was done, Elvis would be informed. It seemed the weight of the situation finally sunk in, and he called the whole thing off.
In February of 1973, Vegas shows brought outright disappointment from reviewers. The Hollywood Reporter went as far as to say, "It's Elvis at his most indifferent, uninterested, and unappealing. He's not just a little out of shape, not just a little chubbier than usual. The living legend is outright fat. His voice is strained. It's a tragedy." The fans disagreed, saying he looked much happier and full of fun. Drug rumors were rampant, and in one after party, a woman broke her ankle as a result of a karate exhibition, which eventually led to a personal injury lawsuit. Elvis' antics confused and concerned many, except audiences. Other performances, he substituted Love Me Tender with X-rated ones, and even changed the lyrics to a song to mock the Hilton Hotel and their showroom because they were going to fire a waiter he particularly liked. The Colonel was infuriated at the bad-mouthing of the Hilton, but Elvis didn't seem to care. The situation turned so ugly that Elvis ended up firing the Colonel for about a week. Fans argued it was like watching Elvis perform in his living room and a rare intimate treat. Elvis even acknowledged they kid a lot and just love what they're doing. One show, Elvis decided to put on a 15-minute karate exhibition. Another show rambled about his divorce and how it was a mutual break, not involving other lovers, but caused by too much trauma. He said they were still best friends, but then went on to make fun of her new boyfriend. On the final night of the residency, Elvis came on stage riding piggyback on one of his friends.
Elvis's divorce would be final on October 9th, 1973. At the end of 73, Elvis OD'd on prescription medication twice. The first put him in a semi-coma for 3 days in his hotel suite while on the tour. The second required a hospital stay to deal with an actual coma brought on due to Demerol addiction. These incidents would lead to having Elvis under a personal doctor's care pretty much all the time. Despite his health in 73 and 74, Elvis performed more live shows than the previous year. In 73 alone, he performed 168 concerts. Some believe performing was the only time Elvis was truly happy, and so he wanted to do it as much as possible.
Post his divorce, Elvis had little interest in recording. The drugs would cause erratic and bizarre behavior in Vegas during his residencies. At one point, one of his bodyguards tells a story of Elvis keeping him up all night. Then just as Elvis dozed off to sleep, the bodyguard took a sleeping pill. Then Elvis requested something of him immediately, and the guard protested, "What's the hurry?" Sensing the irritation in his voice, and despite his better judgment, he came to Elvis to do his bidding. He was greeted by Elvis with an M16 and a threat that he would kill him. Already in a bad mood, that threat elicited a request to do it. A second guard tried to calm the situation down. Once cooler heads prevailed, as Elvis went to put away his M16, he looked at the intermediary and winked, as if it were all a teasing situation.
During one of his stints as a Vegas resident, Elvis pulled out a handgun and shot the TV in his penthouse suite at the Hilton because he was bored and wanted to see what reaction it would get. Another time, a girlfriend recalled when Elvis was in his suite at the Hilton and felt the urge to shoot at a promotional poster for his show with a bullseye on it. What Elvis didn't take into account is that the bullet wouldn't stop traveling after hitting the poster. The bullet passed through the wall and shattered the dressing room door in this girlfriend's bathroom just as she was getting out of the shower. Elvis apologized profusely and the woman forgave him, but at this time in Elvis's life, when no one tells you no, you think you can get away with things like this.
1975 saw Elvis in such bad shape that his February Vegas residency had to be indefinitely postponed while he recuperated in the hospital. Newspapers reported that Elvis was now fat and 40. The performances were rescheduled for March. Disappointed in the way he looked and felt, Elvis would begin to clean himself up, starting to get off drugs and lose some weight. However, even when Elvis lost weight, his intestinal problem from years of prescription abuse still made his stomach protrude, which made him self-conscious and embarrassed. When Elvis began his delayed residencies, he received some favorable reviews. Reports remarked that he looked healthy and sounded good. Elvis would joke about his weight gain with the audiences, too. This residency would see Elvis get into a water gun fight on stage. During one show, he would introduce the Colonel, who came on stage dressed as Santa Claus. A fan gave him a pair of Mickey Mouse ears in exchange for one of Elvis' scarves, and it encouraged a rendition of the Mickey Mouse Club song. Elvis also appeared to be very grateful, almost as if he was apologizing to everyone for sticking with him over all the hard times. At the final show, Elvis shook as many audience members' hands as he could. But it didn't take long for Elvis to fall back into his old habits.
By the fall Vegas residency, Elvis was worse than ever and only performed 3 nights of his residency. He wanted to cancel the 3rd night's show, but the audience was already in their seats and the Colonel refused to inform that he wouldn't be performing. Instead, he told Elvis if he wanted to cancel, he would have to go out there and tell the audience himself. Elvis decided to go on, but was clearly not interested in being there and could be seen checking his watch regularly. The next day, notices were put up all over the Hilton, informing the remainder of the residency was canceled due to illness. Elvis was already gone. It was rumored he left on a stretcher, but in reality, under his own power, around 6 in the morning. The Colonel set to work informing the Hilton that he would work with Elvis to reschedule the dates for a December residency. The Colonel worked with the Hilton to recover losses from the cancellation. As expected, an Elvis residency in Vegas caused rooms to be full when they are normally at 50% capacity this time of year. But it was widely reported that the Colonel had a gambling debt to the property for up to $5 million, and he wanted to make sure he was in good standing with them, so they didn't push the issue of collection. When they returned in December, the residency yielded the same results. Sellouts, onstage, mean-spirited comments that would cause band members to quit after the shows. However, critics remarked that he looked better. He began taking requests from the audience.
By 76, those closest to Elvis began to tire of his downward spiral. You couldn't dare express your concern to Elvis regarding, because he would just cast you out of his inner circle. When he went back out on the road, it was largely with a new band because the old band was tired of his antics. Over time, some would return, either out of love or because they received a hefty pay increase. Elvis' condition scared many close to him. Stories of inaudible singing performances where he was barely able to stand, and multiple other instances that caused those to believe it was only a matter of time before he died. In 76, Elvis didn't perform at the Hilton in the spring. Vegas didn't see him until December, and like most Vegas runs, it started out well. However, it quickly fell apart as he fell into his normal erratic behavior. He would complain about the Hilton, the showroom, the sound equipment, and even told the crowd one night that he hated Las Vegas.
December 12th would be the last time he ever performed in Las Vegas. After a particularly bad night at the tables, even the Colonel told a group of European fans hoping for an introduction to Elvis that, "My artist is out of control." reports of a potential OD happened before the final night of the residency. One fan reported that it appears only a matter of time before we lose Elvis and wondered if people weren't continuing to show up for shows because even they knew any performance could be his last.
In early 77, the fat Elvis that has become a staple caricature of him was a shadow of the artist and man he was less than 10 years before. He was overweight, sluggish, and in a haze from constant daily consumption of prescription medication. Despite the rapid deterioration of his health, he continued touring. He struggled to make it through abbreviated concerts around the country. It was around this time that fans started to share their disappointment about the performances. In one Louisiana show, he was on stage less than an hour and was impossible to understand. After he failed to appear in another because he couldn't get out of bed, the rest of the tour was canceled.
August 16, 1977, Elvis was found dead in his home of what is believed to be a massive heart attack. He was 42 years old. However, many believe it wasn't a direct result of the drugs he abused. It was what those drugs did to his body that brought on an issue that killed him. At the time of his death, Elvis' first name was the most recognizable in the world. He outsold Valentino, Frank Sinatra, and the Beatles combined, and had more gold records, 270, than anyone in history. To this day, he still holds that record for gold and platinum records, but the Beatles have gone on to outsell him. He would go on to sell out 837 consecutive shows over his seven-year residency and sold over $164 million worth of tickets in today's money and performed for 2.5 million people.
There will never be another Elvis Presley, the same way you can never lose your virginity twice. Elvis invented, inadvertently, modern-day celebrity. Artists of the time and over the years have expressed how important Elvis Presley was in their lives. Bob Dylan said listening to Elvis for the first time was like busting out of jail. John Lennon said before Elvis Presley, there was nothing. The fact is, Elvis Presley changed everything. A month before I began writing this piece, Elvis was nothing more than a curiosity to me. One throwaway visit to Graceland during a weekend visit to Memphis that I thought would be nothing more than a I've been to Graceland sparked a curiosity that not only inspired me to write this piece, but to explore far more about Elvis' life and career than I would ever need for a 360 Vintage Vegas segment. In short, despite all the kitsch you've come to know, check out Graceland if you get the chance. It might just change your perspective of the life and legacy of Elvis Aaron Presley. What a fascinating person. It's the longest vintage we've ever done, and it's only the Vegas portion of Elvis' life. This man is absolutely captivating. At least I feel he's absolutely captivating. Never in a million years thought that I would not only become an outright fan, but become so enamored with such a character.
Yeah, and such a rich story to go over to. And you know, like you said, there's so much more to his life that can be found out there. It really is amazing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And on the blog, we'll definitely reference what I think are the two best books ever written about Elvis.
Absolutely. And if you want to check out those notes for all of the information that we referenced for this Vintage Vegas on Elvis Presley, you can do that on our blog at 360vintagevegas.com.